Hello and welcome to a new episode in the New Books and Gender Studies podcast. I'm one of the co-hosts of the channel, Kyle McMillan, and today it is my pleasure to be with Professor of History Steve Tripp from Grand Valley State University, and today we'll be talking about his new book, Ty Cobb, Baseball, and American Manhood by Roman and Littlefield. Professor, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Okay, so first, do you want to kind of give the listeners a rundown of your sort of academic career and what led you to eventually write this project about Ty Cobb?
Sure. I got my PhD at Carnegie Mellon, which is, at the time, and I think this is still true, the only program in the country that is actually a PhD in social and cultural history. I was hired by Grand Valley State University right out of grad school, and to teach primarily Civil War and Reconstruction, which I did quite happily for, 10, 12, maybe even 15 years, something like that. But at a certain point, I started to get sort of bored teaching the same courses, and my own kind of intellectual interests were moving in other directions, particularly in terms of areas of masculinity. And at the same time, I was also teaching our writing history course. And I realized in talking to my students how much many of them absolutely loathed reading history, at least academic history. And so this book was really something of a experiment to see if I could write a book that would be of real interest to my students, that's something that they would actually want to read. Why Ty Cobb, and why talk about Ty Cobb within the context of manhood? I didn't want to leave behind my interest in the Civil War completely. And in fact, I had been making kind of furtive efforts to study Southerners after the Civil War and after Reconstruction. And I was interested in how they kind of went on with their lives after defeat. And no one had really written on that topic. So that fascinated me a little bit. And at the same time, I just happened to watch the film Cobb, which is a kind of a biopic about Ty Cobb. Not a very good one, but it is a biopic. And from that, I thought, well, geez, I want to know how much of this is really accurate. So I picked up Ty Cobb's autobiography, and which he wrote really in the last years of his life. And that fascinated me because it was just overwhelmingly an autobiography of Southern honor. And so that was sort of helped me to answer the question of where Southerners were going after the Civil War. At least in part, they were finding new venues in which to exhibit and express their Southern honor. So I originally envisioned this as a very short, actually just an article on Ty Cobb and Southern honor, something that would just be sort of fun while I was mulling over these larger questions of Southerners after the Civil War and Reconstruction. But in time, I began to realize that there was a story to be told, a very large story to be told about Cobb, because as soon as you start talking about Cobb and Southern honor, the logical question is, well, how did Northerners respond to all of this? What did they think of this guy? And so here you are. Now I wrote a whole book to answer that question.
Yeah. So in your introduction, you mentioned that, you know, this book isn't a biography of Ty Cobb. And the reasons why you wanted to situate it within this larger conversation of American manhood is you believe there are some misconceptions or kind of misrepresentations of Ty Cobb in earlier attempts. So why did you think it was important to sort of have a re-examination?
Well, what really fascinated me as I started reading about Cobb is how popular he was, because in most of the literature about Cobb, most of our sort of public memory, I guess, about Cobb is that he was just this horribly hated individual that nobody liked him. Players didn't like him. Fans didn't like him. The press didn't like him. But in fact, he was remarkably popular. He was easily the most popular baseball player in the game during the early 20th century. So that, in fact, created yet another kind of question, and that is, well, how did this guy, who was admittedly a very violent and vindictive individual, become so popular? Why did fans want to see this, and in what ways did his behavior, and again, you know, overwhelmed with these notions of honor and such, why and how did that appeal to fans from the North, who were primarily urban at this point, and mostly from the kind of what we call the emerging new middle class and wealthier working classes. And so answering those kind of questions really brought me into the world of masculinity during the early 20th century.
Yeah, so what exactly happened in Ty Cobb's early life that sort of eventually led him to baseball, but also began to shape his views on manhood?
Yeah, well, the way that I handle this in the book is to explain that there was no single influence in Cobb's life. In fact, he had many influences. He came from a very small town in northeastern Georgia, a very, very rural community. His father was a school teacher and something of a kind of a middle-class jack-of-all-trades, I guess is the best way to say it. He dabbled in the newspaper business. He ran for and won state legislature 1 year. Then became a county supervisor for the school district that Cobb in fact went to. So Cobb growing up in this environment was in fact in contact with large numbers and diverse numbers of men, all of whom express their masculinity in ways that appealed to Cobb. And so Cobb became this kind of amalgam of many, many different forms of manhood. Growing up in the rural South, he took it sort of for granted, I guess, the basic contours of Southern manhood, that basically the individual is only sort of as worth as much as other people give them, that the way that one proves his masculinity is by kind of daring acts and feats of bravery and that sort of thing. Cobb himself was sort of always looking for a competition of some sort, and the pack of kids that he wandered around with in the streets of this little town, Royston, were constantly competing with each other in just about everything, you know, not just sports, but also, games at school. At one point, Cobb even supposedly was dared to walk a tight wire from one end of from one side of the street to the other, and did that. He would race across railroad tracks when the trains were coming and that sort of thing, you know, just kind of nutty stuff like that. And all of the kids were involved in these sorts of things. Cobb's father was very eager for him to, in fact, kind of embrace a kind of middle-class standard. And his father was very much a follower of kind of New South ideology, that is, you know, that the South would be would rise again on the fortunes and aspirations of a kind of new middle class of men who are more entrepreneurial and professional. And he tried very Cobb was his oldest son, and he tried very, very hard to fit Cobb into that mold. He introduced him to lawyers. At one time, Cobb went to shadowed a doctor, and even sat in on an operation, so that he could see how medicine worked. At one point, his father thought, oh, maybe, you know, we can have him do a military career. So he was all set to send him to West Point and that sort of thing. But Cobb was really just far too rambunctious for any of that. And eventually, at a very young age, actually joined the local semi-pro baseball team. And that is really what kind of excited Cobb more than anything else, was just playing ball. And so eventually Cobb's father had to let his son go. And so at the, what we would consider today, I think, the remarkably young age of 17 years old, Cobb left home to play professional ball, semi-professional ball, and went on from there to play baseball.
So you talked a little bit about this before, but what did baseball mean to the people of Cobb's era?
Well, you know, this was the time really when baseball became the national game. There was no sort of preordained movement, you know, that baseball was going to be the most popular game. And in fact, in the late 19th, early 20th century, there were couple different sports that were vying for that kind of popularity. Prior to baseball's ascendancy, boxing, prize fighting, was probably the most popular sport. Football was becoming increasingly popular, particularly at colleges during the late 19th and early 20th century. Basketball, of course, had just been invented, and so that was gaining a little bit of appeal. But baseball, for all intents and purposes, sometime during this early 20th century, became ascended to the top, and it did so, I think, because unlike the other sports, it resonated most with this new middle class. This is a time in which you know, more and more people are moving to cities, and they are also becoming enmeshed in a kind of new economy, one that they had not heretofore experienced. Historians call this corporatization. Just simply the scale of businesses began to grow exponentially. Of course, among working classes, this meant larger factories and things like that. But for middle class people, it meant larger offices and office buildings and things where they were kind of cooped up as clerks and filers and sales agents and things of that sort. And they're primarily young, ambitious, eager. They like order. They like regimentation. They see that as kind of their the mark of their professionalism is to have rational organization. And so they're immersed in all this, but at the same time, they also realize, I think, to a large extent, the kind of world that they've lost, the kind of more swarthy, masculine world in some ways, but also a world of independence and personal autonomy. And baseball is unique, I think, of all sports in that it encapsulates that tension between being both a kind of team member and subsuming your personal goals for the goals of a team. You have to work together to some extent. You have to play together. It requires a certain amount of order and self-control to, you know, do anything, you know, run the bases, play defense in baseball, pull a double play, that sort of thing. And at the same time, there are these moments of in which the individual stands apart, right? And when he's hitting, when he's running the bases, even at certain moments when he's playing in the field, the ball player stands apart. And so baseball has this kind of appeal then for people who want it both ways. They want that personal autonomy, but they also want to be considered part of something greater. And kind of reflective of that is the notion of statistics, right? In baseball, baseball is obsessed with statistics. And those statistics often kind of embody the personal, both the personal and the group, right? The statistics themselves are personal, but they kind of add up into a kind of group composite. And at the same time, right, they're also just highly statistical. And this appeals to this new professional class who, you know, are doing nothing but pushing numbers sometimes in the work that they perform. So I think that has a lot to do with the ascendancy of baseball at this time.
So did Cobb's version or like performance of manhood match or more shape the type of manhood that baseball was starting to value?
Well, that's a really good question, because prior to Cobb, baseball was did not have, I shouldn't say prior to Cobb, but baseball had very few stars. And the stars that they did have prided themselves on being kind of part of a team, which, right, is very consistent with these kind of middle class values and such like that that these folks have. In fact, if you look back in the late 19th century, really the quote unquote stars of the game, the people who got the most notoriety were not necessarily the ball players, but they were the managers, and sometimes even the owners. That's not to say that there weren't star ball players, but they didn't have that same kind of aura that we now attribute, you know, as sort of the superstar athlete and such like that. And so Cobb is sort of unique in that, and remembering, you know, this guy came from the South. He wasn't at all part of this new middle class, aside from, you know, what his father had taught him, but he was much more sort of enmeshed in the kind of swarthy independence, personal autonomy of more traditional Southern whites. And so Cobb found it very, very difficult to compromise with his teammates. He also found it very difficult to kind of not stand out. He was something of a showman. He liked the public audience, and he was extremely articulate, and even I think it's fair to say kind of charismatic, at least in his conversations with the press. So he really kind of defies in many ways these kind of, you know, kind of staid middle class standards. But at the same time, by bringing attention to himself, by, you know, when he played baseball, you know, the thing to always remember about Cobb is that he wasn't just this great hitter, he was this great baseman. And that's really where his initial fame came from, is his ability to steal bases, the chances that he took, taking dares. He, in fact, you know, defied the statistical odds, as fans and ball players knew it at that time. So he's one of these, you know, this sort of individual who really kind of goes against the grain, I think, of a lot of the received the science of baseball as people knew it at that time. And fans like that because it was, you know, as much as they like the predictable, the rational, the organized, remember, they still are looking for outlets for a different kind of masculinity, and Cobb completely defied those kind of standards of mass, those that sort of staid middle class. And so he fits into this world in ways that in some ways is consistent with the standards of the day, but also in ways challenge the standards of the day. And that's, you know, if you think about it, that's perfect, right, for making a name for yourself, right? You don't want to come off as someone who is completely alien, but at the same time, you don't want to come off as someone who is just like everybody else. So he was sort of the right person at the right time, I guess is the best way to say that.
Right. So you kind of alluded to it a few times, but what did the notion of honor mean to Cobb? And then how did that notion translate to his performance on the diamond?
Yeah. Well, honor meant a couple things, I think, to Cobb. One, it meant always being the best. Honor is, in some sense, a kind of pecking order. Particularly as it's played out in the South. And so for Cobb, always had to sort of place himself first. He saw every competition in life, not just in baseball, but in life, as a kind of competition of self. And so, you know, whether it's battling a pitcher, you know, when he's at bat, or in a batting race in which he's competing with Napoleon Lajoie or Shoeless Joe Jackson, or a contract dispute with the owner of the Detroit Tigers, a fellow by the name of Frank Navin, or in the battles that he eventually had with the president of the American League, Ben Johnson. He always saw those as kind of personal competitions, and he was determined always to win those personal competitions. So that's part of it. Part of it is for Cobb, it meant a kind of extreme form of personal autonomy, that no one would control him. That no one could make him to do his bidding. And remembering again that he comes from the South, Southerners in a generation, two generations before Cobb, attributed the man of honor or the man without honor as a slave. And those notions are still very strong in the South. And to Cobb then, any effort to limit his freedom, to limit his personal autonomy, he took as a kind of threat we use the term manhood and such like that, but it, he really would have seen it as a threat to his humanness, not his humanity, but his being human, being a person, and thinking of African Americans and slaves as being less than persons. That notion then of kind of personal autonomy. And then, the flip side is then that just as he wanted to protect himself from being that enslaved person, the great victory for Cobb was also always making someone else do his bidding, making someone else into a kind of servile to him. And one of the most, I think, kind of interesting things when you read Cobb's autobiography is how often he'll allude to this fact that, when he gets revenge upon someone, he's essentially making them do his bidding and humiliating them in some form so that they are less than human.
Right.
Honor to Cobb.
Oh, go ahead.
No, that was it. I was just saying that's sort of what Cobb meant by honor, how Cobb lived his life.
Yeah, so in one of your chapters, you title it, and this isn't your original words, but sort of how people thought of Ty Cobb. It's titled, "The Most Unpopular Popular Man in Baseball." So what kind of explained this paradox, and how did Cobb's notion of manhood match those of sort of, this new professional man, but also in unpopular ways?
That statement, the most popular, unpopular, I think I'm the only scholar that's studied Ty Cobb who found that quote, so I'm very proud of that. Because it really, I think, encapsulates Cobb perfectly in terms of his relationship with fans. And it really, I think, says something more about the fans than maybe it does about Cobb. Fans, when they go to a baseball game, then as now, I think, are looking for some release. That's maybe less true in baseball, which has become, I think, kind of a more passive sport in a way, but it's certainly true in football. And in some ways, I think, in thinking about baseball in the early 20th century, it's wise to sort of think of the fans in that light is almost like football players or football fans, the Cleveland's dog pound and I should know this being from Oakland, the Oakland Raiders, their fans and their, what do they call it? The black hole. Now fans weren't quite that rowdy. I mean, they didn't, some fans actually dressed up and made a lot of noise like black hole fans and such like that, Raider fans. But, they went to the game really as a way to kind of exhibit a kind of masculinity, a manhood that they were not able to do at the office. The ballpark in that way is a kind of a place of liminality. It's a kind of in-between place. It's not a place where governed by the rules of the rest of society. And so fans could act in some pretty wild ways. And Cobb fit their desires perfectly. He kind of satiated their desires perfectly because he was this kind of player that they, loved to boo. And Cobb himself always said, and this is in some ways kind of Cobb being the master PR person, but also Cobb being the master man of honor, always said that he played to the fans, and meaning he invited fans to, in fact, boo him. Remembering again that, every contest for Cobb is an affair of honor. One of those contests then is with the fans. He felt day in and day out on the ball field that he had to prove himself to those fans. And so nothing satisfied him more than booing fans, because in any given day, he made it his task to turn their jeers into cheers. He's very forthright about this. You know, he talks about this constantly while he was a player, and then years later when he reminisces about playing baseball, that he loved booing fans. He loved to surprise them. He loved to ignite them. He loved to frustrate them. But he always wanted to come back to this notion that eventually they're going to respect him for who he is, and eventually they're going to cheer him, maybe reluctantly, but they'll cheer him. And so, you know, there's this wonderful just sort of dialogue, I guess is the best way to say it, between the fans and Cobb, that they came to try to, as much as anything, to frustrate him and to test his will and to test his skills and to thwart his efforts. And then Cobb, on the other hand, sort of, you know, essentially, you know, standing in the middle of the field saying, you know, come on, I'll take on all comers, and showing on the ball field that he meant that he could withstand their criticisms, he could withstand their boos, and make them cheer in the long run. So he's a fun guy.
Yeah, and one of the more interesting kind of confrontations that he has with a fan, because he had many, but
right,
one of the more interesting ones was when the fan sort of contested his whiteness. I don't know if you want to go into that particular incident.
Yeah, that was in 1911 against in New York at the Polo Grounds, where the Yankees, they weren't called the Yankees then. They were called the Highlanders, but where the Highlanders played. This happened in May of 1911. What's interesting about this, a couple of things. One is, it's part of this series that they were playing against the Highlanders. In the first game, Cobb was actually rewarded with this big plaque from the city of New York and the fans, and they all cheered him and all that sort of thing. But there was one fan who was at that game and then subsequently the next game, by the name of George Luker, or Lucker, depending on how you want to pronounce it, who really, I guess, more than normal, got under Cobb's skin. We're not too sure exactly everything that passed by between them, but Cobb, as we often do, yelled back at Luker, and Luker yelled at him, and you have to remember ballparks at this time period were really very intimate affairs. There was not the space between the field and the stands that there is now. These were smaller ballparks, maybe, you know, holding 8,000 to 10,000 fans, that sort of thing. So generally, if a fan wanted to be heard, he could be heard, and this fan wanted to be heard. And among the things that he apparently said is that Cobb was the product of a relationship between Cobb's mother and a black man, that he was a mulatto. And of course, this was fighting words to a white man, especially a white man of the South. And it didn't take long for things to devolve. The fans started saying these things around the first inning, and initially Cobb, amazingly, with great deal of restraint, tried very hard to avoid the fan. In fact, at one point, he stayed out in the outfield rather than come back to the dugout in between innings, just so that he wouldn't have to walk by this fan. But eventually he did have to go back to the dugout because he was going to hit, and the fan went at it, And Cobb was just fuming, getting furious. And according to Cobb, and, you know, who knows if this is true, but according to Cobb, his teammates, Cobb's teammates, many of whom were not really speaking to Cobb. Cobb was not very popular at all in 1911 among the rest of his Tiger teammates, but told Cobb that he wouldn't be a man if he didn't retaliate, if he didn't confront this fan. And that's all Cobb needed. And without any more to do or conversation, he bolted from the dugout, ran, hopped the fence between the dugout and the stands, and essentially climbed up the, I don't know, five or six rows, something like that, you know, not even using the aisle, and essentially mauled the fan using not only his fists but also his spiked shoes. And really, from all that we know, he became rather kind of unhinged. The fan himself had been in an industrial accident. He was a he worked for a newspaper company and doing the printing. He was a printer, and he had gotten his hands mangled in one of the newfangled printing machines, and so he did not have full functioning hands. And when fans protested and said, you know, this man's a cripple, Cobb said, I don't, you know, expletive, 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 and continued to kick him. Only after his teammates came and essentially dragged him out, you know, did Cobb stop. He was immediately kicked out of the game. And this is where life and the game gets really kind of interesting. Because the fans themselves, and remember, these are New York fans, they were not Detroit fans, begin to boo because they felt that Luker should have been expelled as well. And so then Luker was expelled. And as Cobb walked off the field, fans actually cheered him. And so then you have this kind of, and, you know, Ben Johnson, the president, immediately gets involved in this and suspends Cobb indefinitely. Ben Johnson himself was a kind of self-righteous when he took over the American League. He eventually kind of, he actually sort of invented the American League. He had wanted this kind of very law and orderish kind of league. He didn't like the rowdiness of baseball and wanted a much more controlled kind of atmosphere. And so, you know, he, of course, you know, was aghast, appalled at what Cobb had done here. And so Ben Johnson suspends Cobb. And so Cobb's kind of, you know, in limbo here. And at this point, this is where the life gets really strange, because many players, including Christy Mathewson, you know, who's sort of the saint of baseball or something, you know, comes out and says, oh, you know, Cobb was wrong. You know, you just can't behave like this. His own teammates, realizing that they cannot win without him, actually stood by Cobb and refused to play until Cobb was reinstated. And that led to one game, in fact, where the Tigers had to field a kind of amateur team because the Tiger players wouldn't play. The press was very much kind of divided. Most of the New York press, with one exception, one newspaper sided with Cobb, but most of the press was like, oh, this is horrible, this is horrible. But the fans themselves, by a fairly large percentage, seem to have sided with Cobb. One newspaper, in fact, did a poll of fans as they were entering the ball field a couple days after this event and asked them, if Cobb was right or wrong to go into the stands. And the fans, by something I think like a 3-1 margin or something like that, sided with Cobb and said that Cobb was justified in this behavior. And, you know, I use that event as a kind of example then of the kind of fans' mentality. how, in fact, they liked someone who took it to the man, you know, who fought back, who, you know, refused to take an insult. In their lives, they couldn't do that, right? They were part of a, you know, more orderly culture. But the ball field is different. And they felt that George Lucas had violated a kind of ethic. By calling, you know, Cobb essentially a person of mixed race. And they thought as well, you know, if you can't, take it as well as give it, then, you know, you're worthy of the kind of assault that Cobb, in fact, visited upon this guy. So,
yeah, and I,
you know, it must have been a lot of fun to watch these games.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it was just a very different kind of environment. One of the joys of writing this book was that, you know, I got to read the sports page for, you know, I don't know, 6 or 7 years while I was doing the research. You know, every summer I'd spend my time reading the sports page of sports journals and such like that. And the sense that you get by reading this is that it was just, you know, baseball was just, I think, was just a lot more fun back then, you know, to watch. I mean, it's much more unpredictable dangerous, I guess, in some ways, but just a really fascinating environment.
Yeah, and when Luker kind of brings up to Ty Cobb his mother, I think, even though this is kind of going back into Cobb's earlier life, but I think the relationship that Cobb had with his mother, and then that sort of what it had to do with his father as well, that sort of earlier incident in life.
And that's something that, I mean, the fan wouldn't have known about this.
Right.
Very, very few people knew about this. But, when Cobb was actually within weeks before Cobb was called up by the Detroit Tigers for his major league debut at the age of 18, his mother killed his father under very suspicious circumstances. Ty Cobb was in Augusta playing for the Augusta Tourists, the Southern League at this time, and so he was not at home. But we don't know that much about him. People have come up with all sorts of theories about, you know, what was actually going on. All we know is that Ty Cobb's father, William Cobb, who was then superintendent of the county schools, so he spent a lot of time away visiting, you know, schools throughout the county. And remember, this is horse and buggy day, so he would have, you know, had to ride his horse and, you know, be gone for a couple of days at a time, that sort of thing. Well, one evening, and it was in the evening, which was sort of unusual, William said that he had to go out of town. So he went out of town, or seemed to be going out of town, but then for some reason doubled back. And late at night, the lights were all out in the home. William returned, and according to Cobb's mother, he then tried to enter the house through a window. And Mrs. Cobb had a gun shot at this intruder. At least that's the story that she told. And from there, it gets rather weird because she shot once, and then a couple minutes passed, and then she shot again. And the rumors were, and some people give more credence to these rumors than others, and I don't know. In some ways, I think it's not all that significant what whether the rumors are true or not. But the rumors were that she was having an affair with someone, and that by William returning home, he caught them in the act. And in fact, some of the stories say that it wasn't Mrs. Cobb who shot William at all. It was this paramour who shot him. Cobb himself, again being the man of honor, never deserted his mother. He absolutely worshipped his father, and everything that we know about him, he was absolutely devastated by this. You can imagine, you lose your father and then you find out that your mother is being, arraigned in court, for the murder. That would destroy any semblance of a happy home. Ty Cobb, in all of this, never deserted his mother. He went to the trial. He helped raise the funds for her trial to defend herself. She got off. She didn't spend any time. She often came to visit him in Detroit, stayed in the Cobb household, all of that. There probably is some truth, at least within this Luker incident, that he was highly sensitive to any attacks upon his mother. Kind of reference of his mother as someone who was sleeping around, either with, a white person, but obviously also with a black person, would have been something that would have incited him to go in.
Right. And just for maybe those listeners who aren't huge baseball fans, before Ty Cobb starts to deteriorate physically, how good at baseball was Ty Cobb?
he was just extraordinarily good. There's no doubt about it. And you can look at this statistically, which people loved to do back then. He won the batting title, 11 straight years, or 12 straight years? Jeez, I should know that. 12 straight years, 9 years in a row. He had by far the highest, and still has the highest batting average of any ball player. And you can say, people just used to hit for a higher average. But his average was still, I think, 10 points higher than the number two person. There was one 3 or 4 year span in which he averaged nearly 400. We haven't had a 400 hitter in decades, and he averaged that over a 3 or 4 year period. He was just extraordinary. So much of his appeal wasn't just what he did with the bat, it was also what he did on the base paths. He was fast. There's absolutely no doubt about the fact that he was probably, at least in his prime, the fastest ball player on the base paths. But even more than that, he was just this incredibly astute student of the game. He made every part of the game a kind of science, including how to steal a base, how to slide. He had any number of ways in which he could slide, in that way elude tags and things like that. I grew up watching Ricky Henderson. Ricky Henderson had one way to slide. He always slew head first. Cobb never would have. He did slide head first in his very first time and got mauled by the infielder for doing so, and thereafter never slid head first, and realized that you give away the offensive if you try to slide head first. He had all these different ways that he could slide, and just was incredibly elusive. He also knew sort of. I think partly by observation and partly by intuition, kind of when to attack. and to take he claimed that he was this this great student of psychology, and there's probably some truth to that. He knew exactly when he could unnerve another player by attacking in some ways, you know, taking an extra base or you know, acting aggressive in some form or another. So the fans who, you know, later talked about what it was like to watch Ty Cobb, or the media that really loved Ty Cobb because he was so colorful and so exciting to watch, all said basically the same thing. When you go to a baseball game, you have to watch Ty Cobb. If you don't watch Ty Cobb, you're going to miss something. And so, you know, from the moment he strode to the batting box to the last out of the game, he was the center of attention. And, you know, doing things that you know, no other player could attempt, because simply no other player had the wherewithal, the skill to do that.
Yeah, and I think one of the bigger sort of what-ifs, not only for students of history, but also baseball fans, is Ty Cobb begins to deteriorate with the ascendancy of Babe Ruth. And I think what is most interesting about your chapter about Cobb and Ruth is that not only were they contrasting styles of play, but almost contrasting or sort of evolving notions of manhood, if you wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Cobb encapsulates, I think, early 20th century manhood, sort of pre-World War I manhood. Ruth very much encapsulates, I think, what we would call sort of, you know, the roaring 20s, not just in terms of manhood, but in terms of, you know, the broader culture more generally. Cobb was a kind of Victorian in his constant effort to control and maintain. He was also rooted in the South and again, this kind of rugged individualism of the late 19th century. Ruth is, you know, kind of, I think what we would say, kind of the modern notion of celebrity, someone who just brought attention to himself for the sake of bringing attention to himself. You know, someone who, you know, was known for his gluttonous behavior, his excessive behavior, and that sort of thing. But and there's no doubt about it that at the point in which Ruth ascends and, you know, begins to hit home runs just in kind of, you know, remarkable streaks of power around 1918-1919, Cobb is, you know, at that point in his middle 30s, although still hitting at a very high average, he's beginning, you're right, his talents are beginning to deteriorate. But what's fascinating, I think, in part about this is that, you know, now we kind of remember Ruth as this kind of constant celebrity and the babe, the bambino, and we think, you know, oh, this guy was just, you know, adored and loved. But that's not entirely true. While Ruth was doing this behavior, he really shocked a lot of people and he got into a lot of trouble, I think. Sorry, I won't get this exactly right, but in one year, in fact, I think he was suspended two or three times, either by the club, the Yankees, or by the American League. And he was in constant trouble. And the remarkable thing, I think, about that is that at that same time, for reasons that I think go back to Cobb's ability to be his own best public relations man, Cobb begins to have this kind of renaissance of being the elder statesman of the game, of being the kind of wise, almost kind of like father figure, which is remarkable because on the field, Cobb is as petulant and as disruptive as ever. But the press really painted him as someone who is the good guy. And in fact, in the worst of these times when Ruth is getting suspended and having all these problems, and he had just fantastic arguments with both the press and his manager and things like that, there are a couple editorials that come out during this time that compare Cobb and Ruth and in ways that essentially say, you know, Babe Ruth could learn a few things about proper behavior from Ty Cobb, and which, you know, I think, you know, in hindsight we would say, wow, where did this come from? You know, Babe Ruth, you know, he's the man child, you know, this one evil entity. And of course it wasn't really completely like that. So but at the same time, and this is also sort of interesting that in some ways Cobb kind of got off free, scot-free. Cobb saw Ruth just as he saw every other rival, and that is someone to be defeated. And he detested Ruth, at least initially. And he detested Ruth for a variety of reasons, not the least of which he was convinced that Ruth was racially mixed. And in Cobb's kind of way of thinking, even if Ruth wasn't really African-American, he, in Cobb's view, both looked African-American and behaved African-American. So he was essentially African-American. And, of course, Cobb wouldn't have used that polite term. He would have used one derogatory, pejorative term. And so, you know, for Cobb, Ruth was always this source of this person that he wanted to defeat. And he believed, you know, given his racial sort of ethnic biases against Ruth, that he could easily beat him with intelligence. In the Cobb memory of things, he in fact did that. Cobb claimed that he was able to abuse Ruth to no end, that Ruth never hit very well against his Detroit Tigers, that he kind of had Ruth's number. The statistics tell us otherwise, that in fact Ruth hit very well against Cobb's team and you know, when they went against each other, that in fact Ruth always hit better than Cobb. Cobb himself didn't always have very good games against the Yankees at that point in time in his career when you had to face Ruth. Which is also another kind of fascinating thing about Cobb is that, and this is also sort of part of the Cobb, I don't know what you would say, toolbox of honor or something like that, and that is that Cobb lied. He lied prolifically. In fact, I think that was one of the most enjoyable things that I wrote about. It was I thought, and one of the things that no other scholar has really shown about Cobb is that he was a prolific liar, both during his playing career and after. He believed that part of being honored, part of this notion of having control and things like that, was if you had honor, if you were in control, then your word would have to be accepted over someone else's word. If you lost control, then someone could challenge your word. But as long as you were in power, your word counted. And sounds a little bit like modern politics, but and so he did that with Ruth, essentially, both while they were playing and especially afterwards, and after Ruth died, Cobb could say anything that he wanted to about Babe Ruth, and among the things he said is that he had Ruth's number and was in complete control of Ruth and all this sort of stuff. So,
So we've taken up a lot of your time. I was wondering if you wanted to close out with maybe if people were really interested in checking out your book and then in that topic in particular, do you have like two or three books that you would recommend that people sort of check out? And then finally, what are you working on in your sort of upcoming work?
Oh, the first question, that's a good one. Books that are sort of consistent, I guess, on the same topic, I guess, is what you're wondering. Well, I'll tell you, the historian that I really like, and I think, at least for this project, really inspired me to think about sports and masculinity the way that I did, is Elliot Gorn, who wrote a book, gosh, it's been a few years, maybe 15, 20 years ago, called The Manly Art, which is about boxing in the 19th century. But I think his work is just really, really interesting in how he deals with masculinities. There's also John Casson, K-A-S-S-O-N, who wrote a book called The Perfect Man, which is actually a book. The title is much longer than that, but it's essentially a book about Sandow, the bodybuilder, Houdini, and Edgar Rice Burroughs, the creator of Tarzan, and he writes about these sort of same notions of the changing face, I guess, of masculinity during the early 20th century. So those two books, I think, in particular, really got me thinking about baseball and where baseball fit in with all of this. In terms of my own work, I'm now just in the beginning process of what I think is a pretty exciting project. And it's really going to what is in many ways, I think, sort of my first love in terms of the subject matter, and that's the Great Depression. Both my parents were children of the Great Depression, and I grew up listening to stories from them and from my grandparents about what it was like to live during the Great Depression and all the suffering they went through and that sort of thing. So I've always been fascinated with this period. And I've also obviously been fascinated with the topic of manhood and masculinities. And I've always wondered about, what was it like, for these men, hundreds and thousands, probably millions of men who lost work and struggled and to make ends meet and saw what we now call the American dream sort of evaporate in front of them. So I've been fascinated with that. So pairing those two things together has always been sort of something that I've wanted to study at some point in time. And I think there's a kind of urgency to that at this time because one of the terms that was used to describe these men during the Great Depression has now kind of re-entered our vocabulary, the forgotten man. This is a term that Franklin Delano Roosevelt used initially in 1932 part of his campaign speech to identify those people who he thought needed more support from the government. And so he is essentially kind of advocated for them. And then from there, it became a entered popular culture. A musical number from Gold Diggers of 1933 that talks about the forgotten man. There's any number of short stories and novels that either use the term forgotten man or at least talk about that kind of person, the person who's been overlooked and neglected. And of course, more recently, our president used the term during his inauguration to talk about the forgotten. He didn't say forgotten man, he said, but the forgotten people, and then the men and women who our government has forgotten. So kind of pairing all those things together, my desire here is to write a book about the forgotten men of the Great Depression. Calling it a social cultural biography of the forgotten man. So we'll see how that pans out.
Well, that sounds really interesting. And once you finish that project, we'll have to bring you back on the podcast for that book.
If it takes as long as it took me to write that column, that could be a long time. Hopefully it won't. So, yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed this book. I'm sure other people will enjoy it. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate talking to you. It was fun.